Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and I think you're going to be very happy that you tuned in to the show today, as I have a very special guest joining us, international best-selling author Liza Palmer is here to talk about her brand new novel, Seeing Me Naked. She came out with her first debut novel in September of 2005, titled Conversations with the Fat Girl. It is actually the book that launched Warner's five-spot line. Liza Palmer was born and bred in Pasadena, California, and after dropping out of college and experiencing a run of jobs, she finally realized her talent for writing. Aside from her novels, Liza has also produced plays, and she is a graduate of the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in Los Angeles. She is a very eclectic woman, a wonderful, wonderful writer, and I'm just so happy to have her on the program today. So without further delay, welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Liza.
Thanks for having me.
Well, great. So congratulations on the great success of Conversations with the Fat Girl. And here you are releasing your second book, which is out in the U.S. on Five Spot, and really already getting great, great reviews. How do you feel about this, and did you feel any added pressure writing Seeing Me Naked?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a great line that says, you know, doesn't it get easier to write books? And the truth is you're better at writing that book. So, you know, once I finished Conversations, I thought, okay, it's going to get easier, and it just it didn't. I was good at writing Conversations, and then you kind of have to get a whole other world for Seeing Me Naked. So the whole thing's a dream, though. I mean, getting to write for a living is something that I've, you know, dreamt about my whole entire life. So it's a luxury problem, to be sure.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
How long in between these two books did you have to take a break, or were you just right into the next one?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's a little dirty secret. I mean, I'm already in the second edit of book three. So, you know, whenever you're doing PR for one book, you are already writing book three, and then you're already kind of having book four on the back burner. You're already kind of thinking about the next one. So, you know, Seeing Me Naked was due when I was doing the publicity for Conversations. Seeing Me Naked had to be written in like a month or two, right in there, and then it was edited for a year. So,
really? So that long of an editing process? That's a long time.
Yeah. Well, it is, and, you know, I tend to write a very fast first draft, and then, so obviously it's a mess, as all first drafts written in a month would be.
Mm-hmm.
So my books tend to have to be edited a lot. Just so I kind of keep going back to and you know, kind of perfecting that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Interesting process. So you have a really good idea of the story in the beginning. It sounds like you just kind of get it all out and then go and fine-tune it.
Well, and each book is different. And, you know, Seeing Me Naked is more of a character study, and it's a very quiet, subtle book. And I think it's much different than Conversations and it's much different than Sympathy for the Devil, which is the book three, which is very plot-driven, and it came out of kind of full plot. So it's not this, you know, I was good at writing Seeing Me Naked, and then, you know, Sympathy for the Devil is completely different. So,
and that's not a conscious choice.
No, right? I wish I could consciously stop that.
Yeah, right.
yeah.
So you're actually, this is all happening very, very quickly for you.
Yeah.
How, I mean, if you go at this rate, you are going to have a huge library of books out at some point.
I hope so. I mean, I you know, Conversations, there was a gap of about 3 years in between Conversations and Seeing Me Naked, and hopefully I can get a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
So Sympathy for the Devil should come out in 2009, I'm hoping, and then hopefully the book four would come out, you know, in 2010, so, you know.
Right.
Funny to be talking about these years already, but, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's not that far away, though.
Yeah, they are. Exactly. So, hopefully.
Tell us when you went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and why you ended up choosing writing as your creative outlet. Kind of give us a little history of your path to actually becoming a writer.
Well, I mean, I was uneducable, so I could not be taught. And so I actually dropped out of college after about 3 months.
Oh, that quickly.
Yeah, well, yeah, I knew I was way over my head. So I kind of was a loser for a long time and then decided to kind of, if I could handle school, I think I could probably handle acting school. And So I went to the American Academy, which was in Pasadena at the time, and it was good in the sense that it got me back into the creative communities and kind of networked with people who were choosing art as a career. So I think it had some impact on me. And then through that, I started writing plays because I realized my strength was more in the writing side than in the acting side. But that didn't, as it does, things take a lot of time when you're trying to make changes in your life. Mm-hmm. So I kind of went back and I taught for a long time. I was a teacher's assistant in Pasadena and I started working as a law clerk. And that's kind of where I could see myself for 10 years. And for somebody who, wants to be an artist, to see themselves in corporate America for the rest of their lives is terrifying.
Yes.
So I started going to Roman's bookstore here in Pasadena. It's a great independent bookstore, and they had these Saturday morning workshops with my aunt. And so we would go there every Saturday morning, and there would be like we learned dialogue from Ray Bradbury, and Dennis Lehane did readings, and Michael Connelly came out and all that kind of stuff, not at the Saturday morning workshops, but to do readings at Roman's. And so I would always ask questions like, how did you get started writing, and all these kind of writing processes. So through that, I kind of learned the business of writing. And then that summer, I wrote Conversations, the worst first draft ever, and sent out 4 query letters to agents that I had looked in the acknowledgement sections of books that were like mine, sent out 4 query letters, and one of them asked to represent me from those 4.
That's a fantastic story because I interview a lot of self-published authors and,
right.
We're talking hundreds of query letters
yeah.
and they don't get a response. So 4 and you actually got a response.
Right.
That's incredible.
Well, I think a lot of people send query letters out to the wrong people. They do this kind of buckshot representation request. And I think if you do your, agents are people, they buy what they like. And so if you go to somebody who's representing Michael Connelly, and I go to him with a women's fiction book like I'm going to have, that's not going to work out very well,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of the rejection is based on not doing homework,
mm-hmm.
Although, it's a horrible business to break into, so it could be, homework and, or not,
know? Yeah, right. So
yeah.
Do you think your experience in kind of getting out there, not necessarily writing, but in your teaching and maybe facing some of, the idea, the notion of having to be in corporate America, do you think that kind of toughened your skin a little bit and really kind of, I don't know, really shaped that passion for you that you definitely wanted to be a writer?
Well, I think, unfortunately, for a lot of people who kind of know what their calling is, but, then the calling also to put food on the table and kind of
yeah.
pay rent
mm-hmm.
is the other thing that's like, hey, can't really ignore that anymore.
Yeah.
So I think it's more about the idea that, I think I could live just fine working as a law clerk. It was the idea that I would not have that. It was almost easier to be a loser and kind of have this dream about writing and kind of have these kind of dead-end jobs because in the back of my mind I thought, well, at any point I could go back to writing. And then when I was the law clerk and I kind of bought my first car and I was kind of making good money and I was like, oh, my God, I could see myself here in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually when I got the most terrified. But maybe it is. Maybe I hold on to writing a lot more tenderly because I know the flip side of it, which is, you can get caught up in the grind and lose your dreams forever. And it's so quick and so painless that it's actually kind of terrifying,
mm-hmm.
So maybe that's made me a little more aware of, and also I think because I came into it from the business side and not from kind of the workshops and the college and all that kind of stuff, I look at it like a business. It's, I treat it like a business, and when people kind of, talk about my work and edit my work, I look at it very businesslike and try not to have as big of an ego as I tend to have in most things. So hopefully I think that more than anything has made me more successful than anything else.
Yeah, I think that has a huge part to play in it, to be quite honest with you.
Right.
Did you ever regret dropping out of college?
No. No, I don't think. It just wasn't for me. I was not that kid that could sit still in class. That just wasn't the kind of student I was. It's not the kind of person I am. I think because I didn't go to school or, didn't do well in school, high school wasn't much better. I think there's a messiness to my the way I tell a story that maybe is kind of outside of the box a little more, that I think I benefit from,
mm-hmm.
that I, because I think I tend to, if somebody would have told me how to write, I don't know if I would have written the way that I do organically.
Right. I don't think you would.
No.
Not at all.
Mm-mm. No. I think there's a looseness to the way I tell a story and the voice and all that kind of stuff that that I like. My editors don't like, obviously, because it's a mess, but it comes out okay in the end.
I think people respond to that, though, because that's coming from your heart. So how can they not?
Right, and I think by not kind of going and workshopping all this stuff to death and kind of going to college and stuff like that, it has a rawness to it that
mm-hmm.
I think sets it apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now you've used Los Angeles as a setting
yeah.
for both of your books. Why
and
LA?
And
we'll
continue.
Yeah.
I love LA. I was born and bred in Pasadena, and I mean, you know, Los Angeles does not have a good reputation in the world. It kind
mm-hmm.
of is this kind of, you know, Pamela Anderson-esque Baywatch-ness thing going on.
Right.
But the Los Angeles that I know is much different. And I love spotlighting all these amazing corners of Los Angeles. I mean, I will write every novel I have in Los Angeles because you can write in every corner and never tell the same story twice, you know.
Hmm.
So, you know, Seeing Me Naked is in Montecito, which is this gorgeous town about 100 miles up the coast. And then she lives in West Hollywood, West L.A. But Grace, the character in Sympathy for the Devil, lives in South Pasadena, and there's a lot of stuff in Ojai. And so I'm going to keep doing it because it's just so rich, and it's a Los Angeles that not many people know, you know?
I think that's great. We really need to see more work out there that tells that story about
yes.
L.A. because so much is, you know, what people see on TV, and it's like, oh, my God, Never Land over there.
Right.
What is happening?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think there's some great, you know, obviously Raymond Chandler and Michael Connelly do a lot in L.A., and there's a lot of films that are now kind of being filmed in L.A. and really show it at its best. So there's kind of, hopefully there's a renaissance happening with people kind of falling in love with Los Angeles, like the people who live here do, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I love it.
So what do you do in that area for fun when you're not writing? What are your interests in L.A.?
Well, you know, as a writer, you basically have homework all the time. So there's not a time when you're like, oh, I'm off. You know, there's not,
because
you're always percolating, you're always, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to kind of shut my brain off.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I love Los Angeles. My family's here, so, you know, it's a normal kind of hometown for me. So, you know, and just yesterday I drove up the coast and, you know, PCH, I had a great playlist on my iPod, and I drive up the coast and go to Zuma, and there's a Starbucks up there, and then you get a coffee and you kind of turn back around, and it's just, you know, that's for me, that's the perfect day. You know, and Los Angeles has amazing museums, which I go to, the LACMA and the Norton Simon here in Pasadena, and it's just a lovely place to be. So it's just kind of, I don't know, my hobbies are almost just getting outside and hoping to absorb as much as I can.
That's great.
Yeah.
So tell us about Seeing Me Naked. Give us an idea of what the story is that you're telling here.
Seeing Me Naked is about Elizabeth Page, who is a pastry chef in like a 5-star French restaurant. She is the offspring of this kind of larger-than-life Steinbeck crossed with, you know, Jack Nicholson kind of character, mm-hmm. voice of his generation, the 1960s kind of in Vietnam and stuff, Ben Page. And so she has to, her and her brother, her older brother Rascal, who's kind of chosen to follow in his father's footsteps, and he's a writer now himself, has to come out from under the shadow of these giant parents and kind of, you know, breaking away from that. And in your 30s, I think it's very universal. We all have to kind of come to terms with identity. You know, we are our parents' kid, and yet
yep.
what does that mean, and who are we really? You know, who do they think we are, and are we more like them than we'd like to think? That kind of thing. So it's her journey from kind of playing into that shadow, you know, being her identity is just like kind of the black and white of her father, so she's trying to be nothing like him, but in so doing she's, you know, kind of more like him than she'd like to admit.
Mm-hmm.
So she kind of moves through that, and she meets Daniel Sullivan, who's a UCLA basketball coach, and I think through meeting him, she has to really ask some serious questions about her life and what she wants out of it, and is she really ready for a change, or does she kind of just talk a big game? So that's kind of what the story's about.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I know that, you know, the idea of family just plays such a big role in this book, and I was wondering if this came from things that you discovered in your own life, or why you wanted to spotlight that change that happens in the 30s and the way the family really plays a part in this?
Well, I think it's universal. I think everyone has to kind of ask certain questions, or you should ask certain questions in your 30s about identity, about what this next chapter is going to hold. And I think in my life, it came down to it when I had to pick a couch. I moved and I couldn't take the couch with me that I had. And I realized I had no idea what my taste was, what my style was, because up until that point, I had gotten hand-me-downs from my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so at 30, here I was standing in IKEA, not knowing what was my style, So I think that kind of started the ball rolling as far as, oh, my gosh, like, if I'm not my mom's kid, who am I,
know? Mm-hmm.
And because it's fiction, you have to kind of blow that up to, the extreme, and so that's kind of where Ben Page came from. But I think it's universal, and I know my kink is kind of family and going backward to go forward, how your biography is your destiny and isn't your destiny, how choice and decision is actually more powerful than your biography and kind of your history. And I really like kind of really taking that apart and deconstructing it and then exploring it through fiction.
Yeah, that's definitely noticeable in these two books, and is, what readers are really wanting from you. So that's fantastic.
Right.
Now, the mother-daughter relationship comes up in both of your novels as well as a real crucial relationship. So is that intentional, and what are you wanting to explore when it comes to this mother-daughter?
Well, I mean, I in so many books, especially in women's fiction, there's this kind of adversarial relationship between mothers and daughters. Like, it's almost like a mommy dearest kind of thing happening. And that's not my experience, and that's not a lot of the other experiences of my girlfriends and that kind of thing. So I really wanted to have this support system, positive female support system that I know. And so it's written into my books, and I think May, the character, the mom character in Conversations, is this kind of, brash broad almost that, has, a longshoreman's mouth and that kind of thing. And it's like the whole thing of the lioness and the don't get in between her and her cub, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just really, really, everything she does is for Maggie. But I really wanted to explore the other side of that in Seeing Me Naked, which is, Ballard Foster, the kind of the socialite character that the mom is, and is, kind of came from this very wealthy upbringing where she really didn't have an upbringing. She was kind of, tossed around from boarding school to, house, and didn't really have parents, that kind of thing. So her thing is, I'm going to keep the family together no matter what, and so that makes her kind of blind to the tyranny, almost, of the father. So she's definitely not as strong as the character in Conversations, but comes around in the end, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I wanted to explore different types of relationships that parents have with their kids, because I think it's so important to deconstruct the family to understand how that trickles down to the relationships that you have and keep.
Yeah. I imagine that you have probably done some of your own in-depth work into your own personal history, because if you hadn't, you wouldn't be aware of these types of issues.
Right.
What I mean?
Well, I think the temptation for writers is to kind of, writing isn't therapy in a way, and it's not, in order for the story to really be pure, I have to kind of get over myself a little bit, and kind of the greater good is the narrative, what's Elizabeth's story, and I can pepper her story with my story, obviously, but if it's going to be a good book, it has to be not about me, because my life is incredibly boring. So I'm a good... I mean, I'm a good storyteller. I can hopefully tell a good story, but the less like me it is, awesome,
Yeah,
great. But I can definitely, like I said, pepper, I obviously have issues with perfectionism and all the kind of stuff that Elizabeth deals with, and being, kind of prizing wit over all things like Elizabeth does. And so a lot of the things that she has, I obviously infused, but the greater story is more hers than mine.
Mm.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
After successfully completing the challenging process of publishing a book, many authors find themselves arriving at a new and even more challenging step in their writing career, and that is attracting an audience and gaining publicity for their newly published work. ReaderViews.com offers valuable resources for this important step in an author's career, and they now provide the latest marketing tool, the book preview. These are videos created to promote books in the same way that movie trailers promote movies, and they are amazing. Go to ReaderViews.com today to find out more about previews. Just click on the previews icon in the menu bar for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I am speaking today with Liza Palmer, author of her new novel, Seeing Me Naked, as well as her debut novel, which came out in 2005, titled Conversations with the Fat Girl. You can find out more about Liza Palmer through her website, www.lizapalmer.com. So she's a pastry chef. I'd like to talk food for a little bit.
Yeah.
Where did the idea of having her a chef come from? And I mean, you add so much information and details about cooking. I'd like to know if you cook and, you know, where all the inspiration for the food came from.
Yeah. My, I had asked myself in the beginning of this novel what career I would be interested if I didn't do writing, and I asked that same question with Maggie, and she's an art conservationist, and I thought that was kind of interesting, because if you're going to get married to this career, you've got to actually I have to be interested by it. So in the beginning, I thought, okay, I could be a chef, that would be interesting to me. And then when I did all the research on French kitchens, I realized that the only place a woman could really be is the pastry corner.
Mm.
That's where the women tend to be in these French kitchens. So, and that actually matched with her characteristics of being kind of a precise and driven and very, determined and, kind of exacting. And so when that happened, when I realized that she was going to be a pastry chef, I made a call to a woman named Karen Rawers, who was a pastry chef under Michelle Richard, who is from Citronelle and stuff like that. And
mm-hmm.
She actually teaches at the Culinary Institute here in Pasadena.
Uh-huh.
And so we went down to Bastide, which is this amazing French restaurant in Los Angeles, and ate one of their, the chef's surprise menus, and did this whole kind of, and paired it. The sommelier came out and paired it, and we got a backstage
mm-hmm.
pass, and we kind of went back there and met the pastry chef there. And then, my stepdad is went to the Cordon Bleu, and he also Italian, so he did the whole, at the mother's hip thing and, all that. You can make anything from orzo is my, that kind of thing. So he actually, and his recipe for chicken and dumplings is actually in the back.
Okay.
And that's him.
Okay.
So he's one of those amazing home cooks that can take, that doesn't, in order for me to cook, which I don't do often, I need a recipe. Like, I need to go to the store and, you kind of get your list and you get
mm-hmm.
together and you make something. Don is the same. Is the kind of person who can go into his pantry and make something ridiculous, So
I
that's kind
do
of.
That.
Yeah, I know, because I certainly can't do that. So that's where, and I dove into it because I didn't want the thing about Maggie in the coffee shop. I worked in a coffee house early on, and it's those throwaway lines that you kind of have to really kind of find in order for the reader to know that you know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted that in this one, so I hope I got it. But
yes.
The other person, I have a great flan recipe in the back of the book, actually, and that's another amazing home cook that I have. Her name is Sandra, and she's one of those people who's like, you almost invite her places just so she'll bring stuff, one of those. So I'm blessed to have a lot of amazing people in my life who are these amazing home cooks.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I
yeah.
was wondering about the recipes in the back. I think it's such a great addition, and I want to try each and every one of them.
Yeah, yeah. They're the real deal, and I had to do a lot of things to...
to get those?
To get those, yeah, exactly, yeah. So hopefully they'll be good for you.
That's so what do you think it is? I mean, you've written a book with food kind of, in there. So what do you think it is that we're having this kind of upswell of food on TV? We've got
right.
the Food Network. There's movies coming out with food themes. What do you think is going on? Why?
Well, I mean, I actually don't know what the, I think it's also a tipping point, like just in kind of, corporations and stuff like that. There's always a tipping point where something kind of gets into the, pop culture,
mm-hmm.
Pantheon or whatever. But I think, there's an amazing, it started with Julia Child, obviously, and
yeah.
and then I actually read The Tenth Muse, which was an amazing book about her time and about somebody else's time in Paris during that time. And I think it's just, you know, I don't know, maybe it's that there's different kind of adoration of different types of cooks, that there's a respect now for the home cook, which, you know, I think is amazing. And but I don't know. I think it is more about the tipping point than anything else, about, you know, kind of something getting into the pop culture psyche. And when it does that, then it's kind of everywhere, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. And it is one of the arts. I mean, it's the culinary arts. I mean, it is definitely, and that's what Judith Jones was saying in her The Tenth Muse thing, that it really is the Tenth Muse, that it's this amazing artistic thing that anybody can do, you know?
That's really interesting. I've never heard of that book, and I've never heard of cooking in quite that way. You know, it definitely is an art form.
Oh, it's an art form, yeah, exactly. Well, you watch these chefs on television or anywhere, and it's an art what they do, and it has the same mentality and everything. So it's definitely an art form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now you also deal with the deeper themes of self-esteem and really kind of being true to who you are in both of these novels, and I know that that's going to, you know, play out through your entire career. So was this a conscious decision from the start? And tell us a little more about why you want to tackle these issues.
Well, I think we would all like to think of ourselves as, you know, Sidney Bristow from Alias or James Bond or something, but the reality is that nobody's really like that. And those kind of heroes aren't really, I mean, they're interesting in a sense, but they're not really interesting in a sense that they're universal or at all relatable, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I really like kind of thinking about the flawed heroine, somebody who, you know, doesn't really have any kind of authenticness about them, that they kind of abandon that, you know, life gets in the way and you really kind of get caught up in the grind and you forget who you are a lot of times. And I think that that's so universal, especially with women. So, but these characters come naturally to me, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think the flawed heroine is, you know, it's interesting to be on the yellow brick road with somebody who you think, you know, doesn't quite know if they're supposed to be there or not, you know,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, that's human. There's something very endearing about that. And so I definitely love exploring that.
Yeah.
And hopefully, because a journey is interesting to me, if the person taking it, I can relate to, and I don't think I'm perfect, and so I love reading about that. So a lot of times you just write the book you want to read,
mm-hmm.
so that's kind of where I'm at with that, you know?
I think it's definitely one of the most charming aspects of your books, and it's probably the one that's the most relatable and why women are just like head over heels over your writing, because they can relate to it. It's not like a lot of typical sort of chick-lit novels it really isn't at all.
No.
We're not seeing these sort of cookie-cutter type of characters. So.
No, no, mm-hmm. not at all. It would be a disservice to my readers, almost,
mm-hmm.
you know, to women who can see that, can see through all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We want heroines and heroes that we can identify with and not people that make us feel bad for not owning Manolo Blahnik or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't own any Manolo Blahnik. I don't know anybody who does,
yeah.
you know. How people afford them, trying to make rent, you know?
No,
can't spend $500 on a pair of shoes. I mean, ridiculous, you know?
Ridiculous, I know.
Yeah, so I'm not, that doesn't ring true to me. Not that I won't be the first in line of the Sex and the City movie, but it's more escapism for me than anything else and trying to get something out of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know.
It can be a really confusing time right now because, you know, you mentioned the escapism. I mean, so much of what we're being inundated with right now is just that. So, you know, I feel for younger girls growing up in this culture right now. I mean, don't you?
I mean, you know, writing a book like Conversations with a Fat Girl, I kind of keep up on all that stuff. And, you know, the fact that we have an obesity epidemic and an eating disorder epidemic at the same time just goes to show you that there is an absolute disconnect with this younger generation regarding body image and nutrition and what food really is and what beauty is. And it's just, I am just ashamed of what we've done to these young girls. I mean, they did like a research study, and I think it's like 80% of six-year-olds think they should go on a diet or something. I mean,
oh,
it's ridiculous.
My gosh.
It's ridiculous, you know. And I have two nieces, you know, who are 12 and 11, and I don't know. They just talk differently, you know. They just talk differently about. I didn't know anything.
They
grow
up too quick now.
I mean, I was roller skating and I didn't do any of that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't allowed television growing up, so maybe that was part of it, but I don't know.
Any ideas? Yeah, any ideas on what you think might cause a shift in all of that?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think people, and I just actually did, I'm totally hypocritical, blame media and all that kind of stuff, but the bottom line is it comes from us. You know, when I stand in front of the mirror and say, ugh, I look so fat in these jeans, my nieces are sitting right behind me, so they're going to go, oh, my God, do I look fat in these jeans, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's actually media. I think it's this 30-something generation of women who have been bombarded by all this kind of stuff about what beauty is, and we're standing in front of the mirrors, and our daughters are behind us,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I think the thing that needs to change is actually our perception of beauty and our own worth,
mm-hmm.
and that if you can't do it, if you can't lock it up for yourself, like if you're like, oh, I totally feel fat today, but your daughter's behind you, just lock it up.
Mm-hmm.
Don't say it in front of them,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them they're beautiful. Tell yourself you're beautiful, because maybe it'll start clicking in that you are not your body, and beauty is totally not this, you know, Pamela Anderson aesthetic that we've been selling. And that's not beautiful, you
right.
know.
Right.
So I think it actually starts in the home
mm-hmm.
more than, I mean, we can blame media all we want, and it certainly doesn't help. But I think, you know, we're the role models, the mothers
yeah.
and the aunts and the grandmothers and the godmothers and all these kind of things. So I think actually it starts, the responsibility is at our feet, actually. I really highly believe that.
Well said.
Yeah.
Very well said.
Yeah.
So now you include romance in your book, so we talked about that a little
yes.
bit, and in a very, very clever, clever way. Tell us about your thoughts on relationships and how you're carrying this into your characters and into these two books, because this isn't mushy romance.
No, because I like to look at, you know, because I know in my own personal life, my relationships are absolutely secondary to my family, and, you know, they're kind of born out of that. It's like, how good are you feeling about yourself is reflected in the kind of man that you choose to be with. And I think, so coming from that place, it's, you know, the relationships are always secondary to the kind of puzzle that is this woman's life. And then you kind of see, and in See Me Naked, you kind of see the evolution, because in the beginning, she thinks she deserves a man like Will, who is this kind of bad boyish, you know, well-meaning, but you know, his priority, he doesn't really know how to love, and his priority is his job, and he's kind of, you know, doesn't quite know how to be in a relationship. And in the end, she kind of thinks to herself that maybe she deserves something a little better, and obviously that's embodied in the Daniel Sullivan character.
Mm-hmm.
So I think relationships in my books are more about growth and kind of a manifestation of the character's evolution. You know, so you know that she's getting feeling better about herself because she's asking for more in her relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, See Me Naked has a more romantic element. I think Daniel is a more kind of romantic hero. He's a very kind of strong, able-bodied young lad, you know,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, Dominic, who's the kind of the endearing 20-something love interest in conversation, who's very lovely, but definitely not as, I don't know, like kind of, you know, I don't know, robust as Daniel is, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm getting better at writing. Because if you notice in conversations, I didn't really have any men characters
mm-hmm.
at all.
No.
Dominic is a little, you know, feminine.
yeah.
But there's no. But in See Me Naked, I have, you know, Ben, who's kind of the hyperman, hypermasculine kind of guy, and Rascal, who's the kind of her elder brother, who's kind of this dauphin, kind of this fainting couch, like, oh, life's so hard or whatever. And then you have Will and Daniel. So I think I'm getting better at writing men.
And very relatable men, too, and I think women
yes.
are really responding to these
yes.
characters.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, hopefully, yeah. Because I think there's something for everybody. I mean, if you can't find something in Rascal and Will and Daniel, then, you know, I think that's the kind of the spectrum of men right now, you know, those three.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, Liza, as a woman writing for women, what are you ultimately wanting to tell them?
Well, I think we touched on it a little bit, which
yeah.
is, you know, about, you know, and I think it's the realization that Elizabeth has, which is if somebody sees you naked, which I think is the, you know, all of our fears emotionally and physically, that it's the flaws and the imperfections and the quirks that actually make you you, and that people don't want Barbie, you know,
mm-hmm.
they want you, and it's those quirks and those nooks and crannies in you that actually make you irreplaceable. And so I think that I tried to explore that, and I'm going to continue to do that, in all my books, which is it's those imperfections that actually make you memorable and lovable and touchable and all that kind of stuff. And it's those imperfections that we try to, you know, lipo away or, you know, try to not be as quirky or try to not be as weird or whatever. And and yet by homogenizing ourselves, we disappear a little. And so I think all of my heroines are, you know, lovingly flawed. And I think that that's, in the end, they have to figure out that that's what makes them lovable. So I think that's, I'm definitely going to keep exploring that. Because, you know, in life, we have to explore that.
Absolutely.
You know?
That is life right there.
Yeah.
So do you think at some point you may take a different direction in your novel writing? Or are you even thinking that far in the future?
Well, I think obviously any artist will tell you that it's all organic, that, you know, what comes out on the page is nothing I can control. You know, I can't force, and when I've tried to force writing something different, it's horrible, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I think organically I'm being driven to a deeper book. You know, Sympathy for the Devil is pretty deep and dark, but, you know, these situations are happening to people who are funny. And I think, you know, we are funny, and even though life kind of sends you some bad stuff every once in a while, you tend to keep your sense of humor about it. And I think I like to infuse a lot of humor in my writing.
Mm-hmm.
So the next one is the same thing, but I think there's more of a juxtaposition of the dark and the light in the third one. So I think I'm just deepening. I think that's what I aspire to keep doing, is just deepening my stories and deepening my ability to tell those stories.
Sounds like it.
Right.
Now I want to take a little divergence here from your books, because I'm looking at the clock and time is ticking down, and I really wanted to get your opinion on some of the movies that you're watching right now, because I hear you're a big movie buff as well as a musical lover and a book lover. So if you don't mind, can we go there briefly?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So tell us what some of your favorite movies are, and as well as music.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think my movie tastes are actually quite different than what you think. I mean, the movie that actually rocked my world in the last couple of weeks was The Deer Hunter. You know, the 1978.
That's an older movie.
Yeah. With Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually what I'm watching right now. I think when I'm writing, because I'm in the middle of writing book three right now, I have to read and write things that are completely different from my genre. So I haven't really seen any movies in the theater because I have a very weak mind, so I have to get as far away from anything. So, you know, I watched The Deer Hunter, I watched Fracture, which I thought was great, with Ryan Gosling and Anthony Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched Hot Fuzz, which I love, with Simon Pegg, which is a British comedian who's amazing.
Never heard of that.
Oh, God, it's so funny. But I'm also high into... You know, PBS and Masterpiece Theater is doing the whole Jane Austen thing.
Oh, really?
My God, it's so good. You know, they did Northanger Abbey. They did. They redid. They showed the Colin Firth Pride and Prejudice on television.
Oh, wow.
Mansfield Park. They're doing all of them. So I am absolutely knee deep in Jane Austen right now.
Mm.
I'm obsessed, actually, because I own obviously Sense and Sensibility and all that kind of stuff. So.
From Deer Hunter to Jane Austen, that blows me away.
But that's you know, I think it's not hard then to find out where, like, you know, my characters come from.
Right.
You know, Ben Page is lurking somewhere in a chick lit novel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially Deer Hunter. So I'm loving it right now. And music, I am loving. If you haven't read my brain, listen to Once. You know, the movie with Glenn Hansard, and that they won the Oscar for Falling Slowly. Oh,
yes.
My God, the entire soundtrack is ridiculous.
Oh,
bananas.
I saw that 2 weeks ago. I just picked it up just by chance. I had never heard of it. That blew me away.
It's amazing.
The movie and the soundtrack,
It's the perfect Sunday morning, you know, iPod puttering around the house with a cup of tea kind of music. So I'm listening to that right now. I'm loving Vampire Weekend, which is this kind of quirky little band that they actually just played Saturday Night Live this past weekend.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of, I can't even describe it, but it's just an amazing. And I actually am listening to Rumors, Fleetwood Mac, right now, which that album I just never get tired of. I'm kind of just playing it and playing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Band of Horses, which is I think they're creeping up to be one of my all-time favorite bands. So,
really?
Yeah. His voice is majestically pure, and then they have this kind of twangy country ethereal thing going on, which is, it just takes you, I actually just did a pilgrimage up to the Steinbeck Museum, which is in Salinas.
Mm-hmm.
And I drove up the coast, which that's what I do to kind of clear my head, so I'll drive a little bit. And this time I guess I had to clear my head a lot because I drove, you know, all the way up to Salinas. I had rented a car because, you know, I don't know, I get scared of these big freeways or whatever. And
so I tend to
rent SUVs or whatever. And so I couldn't take my iPod, so I have to bring CDs. And so I brought Cease to Begin, which is their second album. And it's the perfect road trip album. So highly recommended.
Oh, wonderful. You've got quite eclectic taste.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny. But the Fleetwood Mac, you can't go wrong.
Mm-mm. Now, no. I understand that you also create playlists for your character. So what is that all about?
That's about procrastination is what that's about.
Oh.
I don't want to write, but I want to keep my head in the game. So I'm going to make a playlist for Elizabeth, and now let's make one for Rascal, and now we're going to make one for the entire Page clan. You know, and then I also love movie soundtracks. So
mm-hmm.
I'll go online into iTunes and go into the iMixes and stuff like that and find, you know, The Village or Chronicles of Narnia or whatever like that, and then I'll create this whole playlist.
It's great.
It's time-consuming, which is, yeah. Either that or Spider Solitaire. So, you know, they're both, you know, take me away from what I need to be doing, which is the plan, you know?
Oh, well, you know, you have just got to be such an inspiration to other authors, and I know that I saw on your website that you have a little spot there that's dedicated for writers. So tell us why you decided to add that. And, you know, you're giving advice basically. And what can you maybe briefly, because I know a lot of authors will be listening to this, what advice can you give kind of aspiring authors that are looking for that break?
Well, I think, you know, since I did it in a way that was so left field and all that kind of stuff, you know, 4 query letters, never went to college, never went to a writing class, I really wanted to get that out there. And I think it's almost like a, you know, so my advice is very, I don't know, sensible, which is like, do your homework. This is a business. If not now, when? And stop saying, why me? Say, why not me?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's more about, you know, and also, you know, I give different reading lists, which is, you know, Stephen King's On Writing. He says it better than I could ever say it. You know, Annie Lamott, obviously, and Carolyn C., and that kind of thing. And almost just sitting down and writing that first draft, closing the study door like Stephen King says to do. Nobody wants to know you're writing. Nobody wants to read your stuff. Nobody. Nobody wants to know you want to be the great American novelist. Nobody wants to know that, you know?
Mm.
Because 85% of people are struggling with the grind, and they've given up their dreams long ago. They don't want to know that you're trying to do what you want to dream of doing, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of times when you kind of have the first chapter and you kind of print it out for your best friend and they kind of go, you'll stop right there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So my biggest piece of advice is to sit down, write the entire first draft, and don't tell anybody about it, and just kind of plug along. And one of the greatest pieces of advice I ever got was David Ebershoff, who wrote Pasadena and Crown City, came into Romans one morning, and his little kind of workshop was about how to write with a full-time job. And he said, because he's the editor of Modern Classics, so he said that he put a little calendar on his refrigerator, and every day the only goal that he had to do was to write one page. That was it.
Mm.
And then he would put the little one up on the calendar, and you can get the calendar I did from O Magazine, like Oprah's magazine.
Oh, great,
They always put a calendar in the beginning, and I still have the calendars that I use for conversations in my little scrapbook.
Wow.
Because the chances are you're probably going to write more than one page. You'll probably do 4 or 5, but there are some days where all you can write is one page, and even that is like, like word by word. You're like, give me a break,
mm-hmm.
you know? And if you miss a day, you have to look at that blank space for an entire month, and so you're not going to want to miss a day. So
mm-hmm.
you'll write a page, you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the end, what will happen is at the end of the month, you have 30 pages, and that's the hardest to do is to start writing anyway. And then he said, write me when you get to 100 pages. And so I did, and he totally wrote back.
Wow.
So my biggest advice is sit down, put a calendar on your fridge, only ask yourself to write one page in the beginning because, you know, what is it, like Virginia Woolf was like 1,000 words a day and
mm-hmm.
Dashiell Hammett is 9 days and drunk in a, you know, hotel room writing The Thin Man or whatever. But
mm-hmm.
you can take one page a day,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
and that will get you through to the first 30 pages, and then 30 pages becomes 100 pages, and all of a sudden you start to think you can do this.
Yeah.
And And I think that's the piece that none of us, we don't think we can really write a book anyway, you know?
Mm-hmm. But so many people have that dream.
Exactly. But yeah. So many people, I've spoken at so many different events, and every time I say, write me when you get to the first 100 pages, and nobody's written me.
Really?
Yep.
Isn't that
every single time. We're talking 30 people for how long? For since 05, so 30 people per thing, and nobody's ever written me.
Mm-hmm.
So it just goes to show you that a lot of times this dream can be a dream deferred, and that's not, and it will rot, you know, like Langston Hughes talks about, it really will, you know?
I think that's great, great advice.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, another thing that you mentioned, too, is not to show it to anyone. And I think I think that's great because, you know, even with the best interest at heart, some of the closest people to us will actually sabotage.
They absolutely will because not, like I said, there's such a high percentage of people who just gave up on their dreams a long time ago, and they certainly don't want to